Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, my name is Gabby Logan, and this is my podcast, Midpoint. Now, according to the Economic and Social Research Council, I have no idea exactly who they are, but they sound quite important. You stop being young at 35 and you start getting old at 58. So I guess your midpoint is somewhere in between those two numbers. I'm 47, so you can guess that this is quite a self-serving podcast, although I am fascinated in this period of our lives. Are we all still striving for physical perfection, or have we given up the ghost? Maybe you've yet to achieve your life goal and you're still hunting for that perfect 2.4 kids and the back garden and the extension. And does any of that really matter anyway? Does it bring us happiness? We should know some stuff as midpointers. We should be wise and have things to offer to the younger generation. But all I offer my children are many moments for them to cringe. This week, my guest is definitely not somebody who induces cringe, he induces laughter. It's John Bishop, who is one of the highest grossing comedians in the UK. And in 2016, according to Forbes, he was one of the top 10 grossing comedians in the world. So he's achieved enormous success in his chosen field. But actually, John is perfect for this podcast because when he was 40, he was still a pharma rep. And that's when he chose to jack in selling drugs and enter the rock and roll world of stand-up comedy. That was a huge gamble, but it is one that has certainly paid off. And he's come round for a cup of tea. This episode is brought to you thanks to our very healthy friends at Solgar. Now, Solgar might not spring straight to mind, but with 70 years of experience in vitamins and supplements, they're quite literally the gold standard when it comes to keeping your body topped up with those vital minerals and vitamins. I like to think my diet's pretty healthy, but I know occasionally I do need to top it up and boost it here and there throughout the year. Personally, I love their rigorous attention to detail, from ingredient sourcing and formulation through to manufacture. They've crafted a diverse range of over 300 different evidence-backed formulas, which allows us all to personalise our nutritional support plan and optimise our health and performance. I'm pretty sure you'll recognise them. They've got gold lids and brown glass bottles. Very chic. They're also available online through Solgar, which is solgar.co.uk. And usually, I'd like to start at the age of 40 because you are unbelievably well placed as somebody who, at 40 years old, if all of your online biographies are to be believed, that is when you stopped selling drugs and and launched yourself into a full-time comedian.
So when you say you want to start at 40, you want me to explain myself
at 40? It's amazing to make such a huge change in your life. Massive change where you're potentially you don't know what you're going to earn, you don't know how your life's going to be.
I had a run up to it. You know, I did my first open spot as a stand-up comedian when I was 35. So that's the first time I walked on stage ever with the intention.
That's
of
quite
trying.
Late though, isn't it?
Which in itself is late. It is very late compared to the way most people start. But the And I suppose from what you're coming from with this whole podcast series, that was probably the start of my midlife at that point where I'm going, why am I doing what I'm doing now? But I never thought it would evolve to anything else. It was literally one of those things that I think, I found myself in a situation where I was in a club and I was asked to get up and I just thought, well, I'll do it once and then, I've done it. It wasn't a thing, it wasn't a desire to do. So by the time I did reach 40 and I decided to leave the job and cut all ties with it, I'd had 5 years of learning that I could do it.
So what was the goal then? Did you say to yourself, because you must have had some kind of parameters you were working within, that if I haven't earned X amount by this next year, or I've got to be appearing on the Apollo, what were the...
No, it was very, I'm not even sure the Apollo had started then, or it was just starting. I think it was Jack D's show at that point. My aspiration was not to need to report to someone else ever again. That was my aspiration. So I looked at it, and at the time I was doing sportsman's dinners. I was getting a sportsman's dinner around about once a month. And I could get like 700 quid for it. And then you add that into doing a weekend at the Comedy Store or something like that, where you might be getting 150-200 quid for a gig, and then you go, well, if I do them, and then particularly if I came down to London where you could do 4 gigs in a night, and then I started thinking, well, if I mix it up, because I was still living at the time up in Manchester, do a gig on a Tuesday night somewhere, get 60 quid for that. So I was picking all of these little bits up and go, right, if I went self-employed instead of being an employee on a PAYE with a pension plan and all that, I could net nearly the same, you know, with the tax differential of being self-employed.
Because it's not a crude question, because you've got 3 young kids.
Yeah, this is.
And a wife.
Yeah, this is like economics. This is me going, you know, I've got, and the kids were at the time at a fee paying school, and you go, well, we've got that to cover. I've got a mortgage. I've got my wife, and Melanie at the time wasn't working because she couldn't work because I had a job and I was doing stand-up comedy. So there's no place in the schedule for Melanie to be able to do anything. And we just sat down, and she was brilliant. You know, because I left the job with a pension plan, health insurance, company car, expense allowance, massive career
your
structure.
Your coffee's here.
Oh, good man. There you go.
Anytime, sir. Thanks for that.
There you go. And see, and Kenny's done well with his job change as well.
he's got to make a lot of coffee though to make up for being an international rugby player.
But you know, so there is a little bit where people go, oh, you can follow your dreams. You go, yeah, but your dreams have to have some basis of reality. Mm. You know, I would never advocate people just, you know, they go, I'm 40, I'm bored with my job as well. So I've always wanted to be an artist and go and be one. You got to prove you can do it.
Did you have a spreadsheet? Did you?
Oh, I did the whole thing. Literally sat down, did it. Because again, that was one of the interesting things when I moved into stand-up comedy. I remember meeting my agent now, Lisa, and sitting down with her. And she'd come to see me and said, you know, I'd like to represent you. And I said, okay. And I went down for a meeting with her. And I sent her an agenda in advance. She said, no one's ever done
Which
that.
Comedian's ever done that.
I've got an agenda, item 4.
So you had the confidence to feel you could earn a living, and you knew people were laughing at the things you were saying.
Yeah.
Do you think, and you mentioned, oh, he's quite good at it, yeah.
Good coffee
maker. Do you think if you were a woman in that situation at 40, it would have been as easy? And you mentioned Mel kind of almost had to sacrifice what she was doing to keep everything going at home. Do you think a woman would have found it?
Well, Melanie, it evolved that situation because me and Melanie had split up. And when we'd split up for 2 years and we were living apart, the kids were with a child minor because she was at work, and then they couldn't go to kids club and couldn't have friends back. So we got back together. And when we got back together, the agreement was she was going to give up work so that the kids could have some stability and enjoy the stuff that they'd not been able to do. And us getting back together and me leaving my job all happened within a 3-year period, if you see what I mean. So it was kind of all part of the package. But yeah, it was a big decision. And I think if I look at it from a male perspective, I can only look at the access points of going into comedy. And the reality is, it is a male-dominated industry. And it's not that women aren't funny or anything like that. It's the fact that people don't understand how lonely it is. Mm. You know, if you're a stand-up comedian, and it's great if you're doing arenas and everyone's looking after you, but to get to that level, you know, you've got to drive on a Tuesday night to go and do a gig in Leeds.
Which, if a woman had 3 kids, it'd be a lot harder, wouldn't it?
It'd be unbelievable, even if she's got a supportive partner. Mm. And I don't even mean the driving somewhere and getting there. I don't mean any of that. It's just that little bit of you're on your own when you get there. You've got to, you know, walking into some dodgy clubs of a night, then got to do your set, get paid, get out. It's not as conducive to middle-aged men as it is to young men, and it's certainly not as conducive to women as it is to men.
And what about the young men? Young women, or, you know, young people, when you are 35 starting out and then 40 doing it full-time, you must have come across a lot of young comics who looked at you almost in a vuncular way.
Well, yeah, what are you doing here, Cladnob? Well, you know, what I found absolutely the best thing about comedy and falling into comedy is it's a little club. You find yourself part of a society of these strange, needy people who want to go on stage and make other people happy. And so as a result, there's not a single comedian I don't respect. And I haven't met a comedian who's necessarily is judgmental of other comedians. Even if they don't like their style of comedy, they don't like what they do, because everybody shares the fact that you walk on stage. So if you happen to be the 40-year-old bloke who's coming on stage doing a gig and there's another lad who's 17, you're in the same boat. Like, I remember I was compared of Jack Whitehall's first gig at the Comedy Store, and he'd come to do an open spot, and he was only 18. And then I was, you know, on the circuit doing a compare. Then he went to Manchester University and phoned me up when he was at university because he started the comedy club and booked me for 40 quid, literally for 40 quid, which he never gave because he didn't get enough tickets. He paid me in laughing gas. So there is, you're equal. You're very much equal. And that's why, if you look at the older comedians, your Jimmy Tarbucks, Mick Miller is an old-time comedian who used to be on the comedians on telly. Mick's in his 70s. Every comic on the circuit who ever works with Mick thinks he's brilliant. Age has got nothing to do with it. Age can help with comedy.
So, which is unusual. A lot of midlife changes, that would be one of the fears that people would have, I guess, that you would... Because I remember when we lived in London and we were renting a house, we were doing a house up, and the house we were renting was a woman who was retraining from being a banker to becoming a doctor. And she was in her late 30s, which is a huge life change at that age. She had three kids. And I kind of felt that the huge rent we were paying was helping to fund the NHS because we were providing a new doctor. That's how I justified it. And I had such respect for her because it was something she wanted to do her whole life, and she took that leap into doing it. She'd be working with young doctors, obviously. She was going back to college with kids, you know, who were, you know, coming through medical school. And that is quite daunting, isn't it? When you know stuff and you've had life experience and then you're jumping in.
You're dealing with... Well, from a comedian's point of view, it's great because you've got more material to draw on. Yeah, you've had more life, so you've got more to talk about. And that definitely helped me. But also, you know, like medicine is a... what's the word that I'm after?
Vocation?
Well, it's an examination-based thing.
Yeah,
isn't it?
You pass the exam,
you're going to be qualified to be a
Whereas
doctor.
Whereas, obviously, it's very subjective. Most
things are subjective when you think about most careers. If you're applying for a job, somebody's got to approve you. There might be an interview with one person on an interview board. But when you're a comedian, you're getting interviewed by 150 people in the room. And therefore, it's a real meritocracy, because if you say something... Because it's instant communication. As soon as you stop speaking, people laugh or they don't laugh. Mm. That's the end of it. Mm. And you're judged in that second. And so it's a real meritocracy, because if you get more people laughing than everybody else...
You've won.
Everybody else on the lineup goes, he's good. And it doesn't matter if you're 15, you know, or you're 70. If you've said something, everyone's laughed. You go, yeah, that's right.
So... this works well, this new career, and with it comes fame quite quickly. You know, you become well known and people start to talk about you. And I wonder if that is easier to deal with when you are in your mid years, or whether it's even more confusing than it would be if you were younger.
It's slightly confusing. And I know we've been having some conversations with our kids lately, and they were saying how confusing it was for them, because they were teenage kids who'd had an ordinary bloke as a dad, and then And then there's somebody famous living in the house. And that's a weird change.
Is this a lockdown conversation, by the way? Because it's interesting that lockdown does bring up stuff,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah,
and that you might not have talked about for 20
and
years.
Not all of it was positive, they said, because they people then expect them to be a mini version of the person that they've seen on the telly. And so I think for the family, we went through a lot of changes. And it was unexpected changes because I basically wanted to, I said to Melanie, listen, I think if I do what I'm doing now and I get these sportsmen's dinners, it'll be enough. And I promise you, we'll be okay. And then the first year, I didn't make as much. And we're having to borrow money against the house to pay for school fees and everything else. And then the same with the second year. And the third year, I thought, God, I've got to at least break even. And the third year, and then the fourth year, we're off.
Had you not, in that third year, do you think you'd have been back to selling pharmaceuticals?
Well, I was already in trying to put together management presentation skills courses based at the Comedy Store in Manchester, going, come on, I'll teach your management team how to do presentations in a funny way. And I've got it, the file. I found the file, again in lockdown when I've been going through files.
Is there a business there waiting
my
to come
God,
out?
It still reads as a definite business plan, you know what I mean? I don't know. I honestly don't know.
What was the moment where you thought, oh my gosh, I am really famous now. This is, my life is
well, you, it's
not
different.
My own.
See, because you've been in this environment and because of your dad as well, you've had you've seen the world through a prism of being recognised. And that I think as you grow older, that influences how you expect people to react to you. And I remember the first time I started getting recognised, because I'm not always great at remembering people I went to school with and stuff, and people come on, go, all right, John. And then I think, I must have gone to school with them. So I go, all right, how are you? And they go, no, fine, it's great. And I go, how's your mum? And they go, do you want to know what my mum for you? Weirdo. Because I thought, I must know them. Why are they talking to me? And then you kind of reach a point where you go, oh,
I don't
that's
know
why I don't know.
Well, that's what I was like with my dad growing up, because I thought my dad knew everybody. I thought he must be such a friendly man, when I was about 6 or 7, because if you're the child of a footballer, you live in the town generally where they play.
Yeah.
So the attention is positive generally, unless they're having a bad time. People want to say hello. So I it took me till I was about 15 to stop saying, who's that?
Is he your mate?
Yeah, for God's sake, Gabby, I don't know. But he was really good at chatting to everybody, which was a nice lesson, I guess, as well, because he was, even though he was painfully shy.
And that's the thing that, as you say, when you enter that world of celebrity, for want of a better phrase, you don't realise that you've brought everyone else in without, and they didn't vote for that. They didn't ask for it. And I always think, it would have been easier if our kids had grown up around it, because they wouldn't have had that change.
Mm.
Because we moved, and where we moved to is a nice area. And so, I never liked the idea that we were paying for their education. And we only did it because the schools that were available to us were in special measures. So we did that thing that you kind of do as a middle-class parent, you do the best that you can for your kid, or you think it is. When we moved somewhere that was nicer, I went, we can stop doing that. They can go to the local comp, which they did. And they all went to the local sixth form college.
And was that better or worse?
Because they've always got on with,
everyone.
Mixed with everybody anyway. But again, in these conversations, I didn't realise that walking into a new comprehensive school when you're 14, 15, with a famous dad, is not the same as walking in without a famous dad.
Mm. Now that you have it, I think you're in top 10 Forbes in 2016 in terms of global career earnings for comedians. So they say. I mean, I haven't checked your tax records, but I'm sure it's all there. But that's that's success by anybody's measure, isn't it? And that is a wonderful position to be in. So how do you, when you get up in the morning, when you've got that level of success, how do you motivate yourself as a comedian?
The hardest thing, there was a phase, and it was necessary that I went through it, where I did a tour called a Sunshine Tour, I'd bounced on. I'd done one tour, done another tour, and then all of a sudden I did this tour, and I spoke about being famous and some of the stuff I'd done on telly. Because I thought, I've got to tell these people what it's like. And there was one reviewer who said, you know, you go and watch John Bishop, and the problem is he's now telling you about his famous celeb mates. And I thought, you've missed the point. I'm telling you that I've walked through a door I was never expecting to walk in. And now this is what it's like. And so I was explaining about what happens when you go on the Jonathan Ross Show and stuff like that. But I had to do that because it was felt to me like I had to explain to everyone out there what it is. Now, when I go, you know, the last tour that I was doing, I'm talking about being in my 50s and getting old and relationships. I don't talk about that anymore because I don't feel I need to explain it. Because I look at it and think, well, if you're a comedian, what you've got to do is talk to people about a world that they can recognise. And obviously, from my point of view, because the trajectory was so good, I thought I had to explain to everyone what was happening. But now I've done that, I don't have to do it anymore.
While you're earning millions from tours, to start pretending that, you know, your car's broken down.
Didn't get it, I was doing that flat pack from IKEA. because that was the life I lived. I can't pretend that I live that life now in terms of, but my life is as normal as more
by
normal.
By design?
Yeah, I learned that very, very early. When I started getting recognised and I went through that phase of, people,
other famous... Inviting you places.
You're going out with other famous people and then they're turning up and they've got caps on and sunglasses on. Oh, that's the way, that's what you got to do.
How long did the cap phase last?
Oh, it didn't look like, not long, because I just looked like me with a cap on. So I was not disguised at all. And I also thought, what am I doing? This is just ridiculous. Yeah. You're just drawing attention to yourself. And so I think the more normal you are, the more normal everyone is around you.
I think it helps as a comedian as well, doesn't it? To retain that level
Absolutely,
of authenticity.
Absolutely, of course, yeah.
So you mentioned getting old, and you've written about getting old as well. What, for you, has been a kind of moment where you felt, oh, I'm not... Because I sometimes forget. I look in the mirror and genuinely I'm shocked that I'm 47, because inside, I still feel like I've got the enthusiasm to do projects and take on things. And, you know, and then... I'm not 28 or I'm not 20. What is it? Was there a moment in the last few years where your kind of mortality hit you in the face?
Well, there's been a few moments. I mean, I had one moment where I had a proper health scare.
Maggie's come to see you.
I had a proper health scare where I'd been on tour and I couldn't get rid of this cough. And I went to
the... You know they're quite popular.
Yeah, these days, you're like, I started the trend. And couldn't get rid of this cough, and I went to the GP, and he said, look, you've had it for now for more than 10 weeks, and the NHS policy is that we've got to send you for the chest x-ray. He said, but I don't think there's anything there. Send me for the chest x-ray. Comes back, says everything's fine. And then the week later, he phoned me up. He said, look, I'm really sorry. The chest x-ray has been reviewed. And you've got shadows on both of your lungs. And I went, oh my God. I said, what's that mean? He said, well, I don't want to prompt anything, but that's never good.
No.
He said, so I suggest you, he said, I will try and get a scan done as quickly as I can, or go down the private route and try and get it done as soon as you can. So I booked the scan at the local hospital, and Melanie heard me talking about it, booking a scan, and she thought it was for one of my parents, saying what's wrong, because I didn't want her to know. So in the end, I told her. She came with me, and it was one of those things I thought...
Why didn't you want her to know?
Because if it was what it could have been, it was, you know, there was no way out of it. It was also one of those things I thought, oh my God, that's it, this could... Because he basically said, if this is cancer in both lungs, there's not a lot
like
we can do about it. And I thought, and there's a moment where I thought, oh God, that's good, isn't it? At least I've had a go, you know what I mean? I can have a rest now. I don't have to worry about anything because I'm going to die. And so there's an element to that in it. But then I went for this scan and he did the scan. And it turned out for somewhere in my life, I've broken my sternum. And obviously, as a kid, we're not in it. And so there's a big lump of calcium at the front of my sternum.
Oh, like calcium deposits at the front of your sternum.
Which when they x-ray it from the front, throws shadows into my lungs.
Wow.
So the x-ray looked like there was nothing down for me, but they, obviously the scan was. And that was...
So you literally went in and came out with a complete clean bill of health.
Clean bill of health, yeah. I've just got a really hard chest. And it was one of those things that I went in thinking, somebody here could tell me I've not got long left. And that was a real mortality moment where you think, right, have I done the right thing by everyone I wanted to do? Have I lived the life I wanted to live? Have I, you know? And there's always going to be regrets in life. But I kind of resigned myself to think, well, all right, for everything I've got right and everything I've got wrong, the balance is more right than wrong.
Did you have a checklist as well of things that you would have done if you had the worst news?
No, because I tried to do it. I actually thought, right, what am I going to do if I do a bucket list? Because I've been in that situation before with other people who've had bucket lists, and one of them is to like come and see you and stuff like that. I thought, right, I'll try and write a bucket list down. And I just had, stay at home more. That was the number one. And look what happened. We've all got it. But I did, I just thought,
what
I thought,
you wish for.
I thought, I don't need to write anything else. Yeah. I just need to be at home more.
And so that's a major kind of, I imagine, a moment of clarity in your mind. In terms of what it did for you with your health, you're already a vegan and you have been for a long time. You haven't jumped on any recent bandwagon. This is a lifestyle choice for a long time.
No, I haven't eaten meat now for 35 years.
Wow.
And the veganism has been more recently.
You're never overweight. You used to be a footballer. You've done an incredible...
Don't say I'm never overweight. One of my mates was in our garden the other day, and Melanie loves it if anyone calls me fat. She thinks it's so funny. And he did this BMI test, and apparently on the BMI, I'm high.
Kenny and Ruben are grossly and morbidly obese on
well,
the BMI.
So. I tell you what, they've... Because on another time I had this, because I had this thing done, then I had the skeleton scan as well, and apparently I genuinely have a heavy skeleton. Genuinely.
You're heavy boned.
I'm heavy boned.
So, but you did that amazing comic relief challenge, which raised 4.2 million, I think, overall. I can't believe I'm not talking to Sir John Bishop. You must have done something wrong to not get the knighthood.
Yeah.
But you did, what was it, a triathlon? In, you cycled the length of France.
No, I basically carried the world on my back and ran up a hill. No, it was a thing that Greg White devised, who advises Comic Relief and Sport Relief all the time on these things. And it's a challenge, but the challenge is normally the other way. And it was like people run to the coast, swim over, and then cycle to Paris or something like that. And in the end, we had to adapt it to come back.
You've got to have the glory moment in London. You
exactly,
can't have the glory moment in Paris.
So it was a cycle from Paris to Calais, which was 186 miles. Then, instead of swimming, it was rowing across. And then instead of... Because I think the challenge that Greg referred to was a cycle from... Cycle, swim, cycle. And then it was a run. I did a run. So I cycled, rowed, and then ran.
And how did your body feel? That you were how old at this point?
42.
Mid-40s. Oh, early 40s then.
Yeah.
So how did you feel as fit as you'd ever felt at that point?
No, because I underestimated it massively. I did 12 weeks training and not properly.
Mm.
And I did massively underestimate it.
I didn't know how much you were acting. It looked painful. I think you were close to tears, weren't you?
I'm not close. I was blubbering like a big baby. No, I towards the end, the last day when I was running, I just kept on getting pains. And then they did that thing where they stopped me to check me. And then Greg checked me, and then the doctor checked me, and the physio checked me, and they all went away and had a chat because they thought...
See whether you could come back on in the second
half.
Yeah.
Because fortunately, it just ended up being shin splints, but they thought it was hairline fracture, and I still had 12 miles to run.
Oh, no.
And I just said, I've got to finish.
It was your Derek Redmond moment. Remember that, 92
yeah.
Olympics, when his dad carried him around the track?
Exactly. But my dad wasn't there. But
Mel would have carried you around.
It was... so painful. I don't know how people run with shin splints.
I've always admired Greg, the way Greg White kind of gets you guys through. I think he did Davina's challenge, didn't he?
Yeah,
he did David Williams as well. And I've interviewed him actually a few times from a sports science perspective, yeah, talking about things like the marathon world record. And so I thought it'd be good to have a chat with him about really a kind of male obsession with lycra clad activities in middle age, because it does.
I mean, he's the king of it.
He is. He's the grand inventor. So let's get him on the line. So I have just the man to talk to when it comes to that obsession with donning the lycra at a certain age, Professor Greg White, who, John, you know very, very well. And Greg, you've helped many people through the most arduous and difficult of tasks through Comic and Sport Relief. And that's probably where people know you best, kind of cheering on those poor souls as they do terrible things. But why is it that I see so many men in packs on bikes and out doing ultra runs? And it does tend to be, I mean, more women are kind of getting into it, I think. But it seems to be a certain age as well, doesn't it? The attraction.
You'll see me donning lycra on too regular an occasion, actually. But we coin it middle-aged men in lycra. I mean, we've actually, it's so common that we've got a sort of catchphrase for them. And I think, I mean, if you think about it, it's a very recent phenomenon. I mean, it is sort of, you know, circa the last decade, probably really the sort of last 5 to 6 years that we've really seen an explosion in that. I think it was probably coined around men initially because it was driven by cycling. As you well know, as many of us know, is that the coverage of women's sport is, let's call it woeful, shall we, but growing. But I certainly think that obviously things like the Tour de France, I think the success of Team GB at the Olympic Games on track, it grew almost exponentially, an explosion of middle-aged men who watched the Tour de France and thought that they could be Bradley Wiggins or Chris Froome, and so therefore they donned the lycra and got on a bike.
In a way, you wouldn't watch the World Cup and think you could be Lionel Messi, would you?
No.
Because, you know, as well as the extraordinary fitness levels, there is skill which comes from the age of about 3. As soon as you can dribble a ball, that's what you're doing. And gymnastics, you're not going to suddenly go in the gym and decide you're going to take up, you know, I'm going to do the rings or I'm going to do the high bar. So I guess cycling, it, without wanting to denigrate it at all, it's quite straightforward, isn't it? You know, in terms of learning a skill, and then it's all about fitness. And so is it the kind of fitness that the middle age is naturally kind of comfortable with, you know, because it's not about huge bursts of speed, is it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. I mean, we call it linear endurance is what we call it. And it's just that repetition. I mean, you know, at the same time, what you've seen is the explosion in running. You know, kicked off in the early 80s with the London Marathon. And now we see, you know, millions of people running marathons globally. And then that's sort of led on to things like Park Run and the millions of people again across the globe who actually
participate in that. Which is amazing. Park Run is,
amazing.
And Couch to 5K, all of that is, I just think, a phenomenal success,
yeah,
in terms of getting people motoring.
And I think you point to the reason why it is successful is because actually it's simple. It's the simplicity of it, which is what makes it attractive. And I think, you know, going back to cycling, it is simple. You get on a bike and you push the pedals around and you move forward. And the wonderful thing about that is it's almost instantly rewarding, is you get to go to places that you wouldn't normally go to. You get a view that you wouldn't normally get if you're in your car. You've got time, depending on how fast you're going, to look at it. You know, for running, you just need a pair of trainers. You don't have to have expensive equipment. But at the same time, I think perhaps the reason why we see it in cycling is because it's boys with toys. And it's amazing how much men in particular, will spend on a bike. They won't necessarily do the training that's required, but they're more than happy to spend
all the gear
a lot of
and
money.
No idea. Is that what
do you know what? There's an awful lot of that. And of course, what then happens is that you bring those all together, and what you see is the most successful sport globally, and certainly in terms of numbers, is triathlon.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about triathlon is it is simple. It's 3 linear endurance events. There is lots of spandex, you know, there's lots of showing off. There are lots of toys and gadgets that you can buy from, you know, what you wear
trips
on your wrist. Exactly, you know. And I think for me, one of the classic things that has happened of recent times is actually the explosion in what we call it masters events or age group events, is that, you know, if I think when I was an Olympian, I mean, age group events didn't really exist.
No.
And yet now every sport that you can mention has age group events. When it comes to cycling, there's age group on the track as well as the road, triathlon age groups. And like you say, there are some great road trips that you can now have as a veteran or an age grouper.
You get that kind of perfect confluence as well of that midlife where you've kind of got to a certain earning capacity, and, you know, maybe your kids are kind of getting a bit more independent, so you've got a bit of extra disposable cash. And so it's not something that necessarily in your early 20s, when you've got babies, it's very hard to justify, you know, going out. Yeah. I remember I stopped playing golf for quite a long time because I just couldn't justify going out for 5 hours, you know, when I had babies. That didn't seem like a very fair thing to do. And as your kids are getting older, it's definitely a lifestyle thing. And also you cycle with your kids, which is lovely. But what should we be doing in midlife? Are those long distance events the best thing for us?
The first thing to think about is that I think we've missold a dogma in society. And that is that as we get older, we can start taking it easy. That is utterly erroneous. It is absolutely the complete antithesis of what we should be doing. And that is that as we age, what we should be doing is working harder. What we have, sadly, men and women, is we have this inexorable decline in physical capacity. We lose muscle mass, a process called sarcopenia. We lose aerobic capacity. And effectively, performance starts to drop off. Now, what we can do with the right intervention, with the right exercise, with the right approach, is we can offset that. It is inexorable. It will happen. But when you take a look at some great age group athletes, you know, into their 50s and 60s and 70s, they are still smashing out performances. And what they've done is that they're not as quick as they were when they were 30, but nonetheless, what they've done is they've slowed that inexorable decline. But that only comes about by working harder than you did when you were a kid.
All things considered then, because not everybody can give up the time and, you know, those cycles, sometimes they're 4 or 5 hours, aren't they? People are going out for on a Sunday morning and during the week. So what's the most effective kind of training? If you're only going to do one thing, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, okay, I'm 42, you know, I'm hearing this and I'm seeing where my, you know, my strength's going and my conditioning, what should I do? What's the best use of my time?
Wow. The simplest answer is that do what you enjoy. I think that's really important, is that because if you do what you enjoy, you'll do it for longer, you will work harder at it, and you'll keep doing it. And so it's far too many times. I mean, I speak to clients of mine who come in and say, next year I want to run the London Marathon. And I say to them, the first question I ask them is, do you like running? You know, and many of them say, no, I hate it. But it's like this social thing that if you are going to do something, you've got to run the London Marathon.
Yeah, the bucket
and actually
list
now, you know, sport, and sort of people expect you kind of to do that, and sportifs have become a bit like that. But actually, I think critically, the first thing to do is think you've got do what you enjoy and what you love and what you're passionate about, and that makes all the difference.
What if they say eating crisps?
Well, that, you know, I guess as Abraham Lincoln once said, whatever you are, be a good one. So if you're going to eat crisps, make sure you're really good at eating them. Apart from prawn cocktail, nobody should eat those, but that's a different story. You know, I think I would say that one of the things that most people miss out when they're training, and this is probably because there is this penchant to move into endurance. People are drawn towards linear endurance and going longer. But I think strength is one of the critical factors as we age, is that we do lose muscle mass. Men at a more accelerated rate than women, particularly as they move into their mid-30s and beyond. And with that loss of muscle mass comes loss of strength, loss of power. And all of those things, they underpin performance, crucially, but also they underpin health in terms of injury
and hormones
prevalence.
Obviously, a huge part of what's going on in men and women as they're in the midlife. Is it true that strength training helps to keep those testosterone levels up?
What we know is that particularly when it comes to growth hormone, and we've published a whole host of studies around this, is that the exercise is crucial in increasing growth hormone secretion. And what we know within that is that the higher the intensity, the greater the growth hormone secretion. So again, it points towards this issue of working harder as we get older. And I think what we shouldn't be is afraid of actually pushing ourselves. I think sometimes as we age, we sort of think, oh, perhaps we shouldn't go that hard. We shouldn't lift that much. We shouldn't go that fast. Actually, as long as everything else is well, as long as we are in good health and we have no underlying conditions, we can push ourselves as hard as we ever did. That doesn't mean to say that it'll be the same power output or the same speed, but we should be pushing ourselves from what we call it a perception of effort. We should be pushing ourselves to as hard as we possibly can as we age, and that will help combat those changes in specific hormones as well as other factors.
Greg, thank you so much. Inspiring as ever. And I think you basically just said you can't take your foot off the gas. That's
Don't take your foot off the gas. You're absolutely right.
That's bad news.
in fact, put your foot down harder on the gas. That's what I said.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Was he interesting to work with, Greg?
He was, but when I was building up to do the runs, because I'd never run a marathon before, and on this particular challenge, I think the first day was like 30 miles, and then I think it was 28 and then 29 or something like that. So it was a mixed thing. And so I thought he'd say, right, in order to be able to do that, you've got to go and run 10 miles a day, and then you've got to go and run 12 miles tomorrow. And he didn't. He said, right, just go out for a 40-minute run.
Doesn't matter how
didn't
far.
Set the pace, go out for a 40-minute run, do that for a couple of weeks, and then make it 50 minutes. And it was all about the time, because what he was saying is you will. Like you could tell talking to him, he's got such a positive attitude. He says, you will do it. Mm. You will do it. The only thing that will stop you doing it is your mind. Mm. So you've got to train your mind to know that this is just something I do. Mm. And the longer it gets used to you just bobbling along, jogging, you'll finish it. Mm. It's your mind that will say, God, I've been running for 2 hours.
But isn't that the way with so many things as well? You know, moving on from physical activity, that our mind, and especially in this period of our life, our mind is the limiting factor, isn't it? You know, when I think about projects I want to do and things I want to start, and then I doubt myself, go, oh, but 47, is it, you know, is there still time to do things? And the mind is really loud, isn't it, at this age?
Yeah, and there's also that thing, like, I've had it with you know, as you say, I've been really lucky in the trajectory of my career. So you think, right, I've just done a big arena tour and go, oh, is that the last one? Shall I just, shall I now just aim on theatres? And you know, you speak to other people in the profession, they go, what are you talking about? Mm. You're still seen in that bracket. They're not thinking of you as a middle-aged bloke in his 50s. You're just the entertainer.
But do you think as well, it's because we've had this kind of obsession with youth as well, and that maybe we don't value kind of longevity in careers. You know, I remember going to watch Bruce Forsyth at the Palladium, one of his last shows, and he was an incredible performer, and it was just unbelievable watching him up close, you know, having been on Strictly. And this is a man whose career was 60, 70 years long. He never thought of stopping. He never thought in his mid-40s.
Well, it's interesting, because I remember going to see Ken Dodd and a similar thing. He was in his 80s then. And there's a stage craft and an ability. And being an entertainer helps. I think when you're in...
You're like the dog man, by the way. All the dogs. All the dogs, won't you?
All the dogs. But there is a thing about... There is a thing about, because you can do that as an entertainer, because you're getting the rewards back. People are clapping and cheering. So if you're in your 50s, like a lot of people are, who are probably listening to this in a corporate environment or in their job, and they've got the young whippersnappers coming up, or they've even got a boss who's now younger than them, and then you start doubting yourself and you feel you're getting edged out the door, because you haven't got that validation of other people saying you're brilliant, you're great, and that's what a round of applause gives you. That's where it's difficult and challenging, and that's why I always look at myself and think, the choice I made is an even better choice now than it was when I was 40, because now I would be that person not sure of myself.
And also, in those environments that you've put my mind into, a kind of office environment where technology is a huge part of their lives, and technology has changed so much in our lives, you know, and our kids have a very different relationship with technology, don't they? And sometimes that really scares me, you know, and I don't know what the future is for them, because so much of their life's on screens.
I had an argument with one of my lads the other day about something. It wasn't a row argument.
Heated debate.
It was just like, I just said, listen, I'm right. And he said, how do you know you're right? And I said, because I've been here longer than you. So there's a good chance that my assessment of this situation is right, because I've been around the block a few times. And I think that's what you need to ingrain. When you get to this age, this midlife age, you need to value what you know instead of doubt what you don't. And I think that is a big thing. And when you talk to someone like Greg, they instill that confidence in people to say, look, you know, your body can do this, you can do this. You're telling you what you can't do.
Embrace your own wisdom.
Embrace the fact that, you know, wherever you are now, you've had, like I was saying to Daniel the other day, the lad, you know, the kid I was having, the kid, my son,
who
was having that debate with. There's a bit about going, like, if I've lived this life even 10 years longer than you, regardless of the fact that it's 20 odd years longer than you, I have experienced things and seen things through a filter that you haven't got. And I think that should be enhanced more. And what's happening in the workplace now is that because ageism is not permitted, there are people who are perhaps being seen in a different way than they used to be, because the automatic thing was, look, if you're not in that senior position by the time you've turned 50, it'll never happen. Whereas now, let's be honest, when you're turning 50, you've still got 20 years of work left. You can start, like you were talking about, you know, that lady you rented the house off, starting a new career at 30. You think about it, you could start something at, you could start something at 50. You're going to be doing it for the next 20 years.
Yeah, it's worth trading for.
Exactly.
Are you hopeful, finally?
I look at myself now, and I'm 53. And I had my first tennis lesson yesterday. Because I've decided at 53, I'm going to take up a completely new sport that I've never done. I've never played
a professional level before. Jesus Christ. His aims are just a bit high here.
I've got
a manager's expectation.
I've never played a competitive game of tennis. I've knocked the ball, but I've never played a competitive game. And I'm thinking, right, I'm going to join a club. And I might do the same with golf, and I'm going to do these things that I want to make myself better. Keep challenging yourself
is so important, isn't it?
It's so important, because I used to play a lot of football, and I don't play any now because I can see myself getting worse. So when you see yourself getting worse,
move on to a new sport.
Do something else and see yourself getting better.
That's a great way to end.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's been lovely as always.
Thank you.
I can't wait to take you on the tennis court.
Oh, yeah, I'm loving that. Seriously, we both got coached by the same fella.
Thank you so much to John Bishop for being our first guest on Midpoint. He's an inspiration, isn't he? And if you're thinking of starting something new, go for it. Get your energy behind it. I'm going to have to really improve my tennis practice. And now, if you're looking to take Greg White's advice and push your exercise that little bit harder, have a look at Solgar's website, because they've got a full range of supplements, including ones tailored to help you achieve sport and fitness goals. Thank you so much to Solgar, to Emily Arthur, Holly Bott and Blaise McGowan at YMU, to producer Emma Corsham at Rethink Audio, and to you for listening. I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.